You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 15th of September 2021 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily is brought to you in association with Allianz.
California's governor gets the all clear to proceed. Is it time the EU learned to fight its own battles and the possible comeback of the woolly mammoth? What could possibly go wrong? I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily in association with Allianz starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests, Holly Dagres and Enrico Franceschini, will be discussing all the day's big stories, and we'll also have a report from Turkey, where, as if refugees in the country didn't have enough to cope with, they're about to become an election issue. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily in association with Allianz on Monocle 24. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Holly Dagres, a non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council, and by Enrico Franceschini, the London correspondent for La Repubblica. Hello to you both. Have either of you been up to anything exciting since we last heard from you?
Yeah, actually, on Friday, I went to Trevor Noah's comedy show at the O2. And I totally didn't realize that was a thing because I bought tickets 2 years ago and forgot about it.
I've heard that from a few people. They're getting those reminders popping up saying, you have a show coming up, and people have literally no recollection of having booked it.
No, yeah. I was just like, oh, happy surprise. Something to do on a Friday night. So
Was it a good thing? Was it okay being indoors at a large cultural event?
I think yes, because, I mean, you had to be fully vaccinated for starters. They weren't going to let you in unless you had an NHS pass, and they had some machines that were working. And, I mean, I didn't show up with a mask, but I think some people did. I felt relatively safe because it was such a big open area and not so many seats were full. So I think that was helpful.
This is exciting times, I think, Enrico, for those performers who generally struggle to fill venues. They can now at least claim that they're being socially responsible.
Yes. Yeah. My excitement was that I've been twice in Italy in the last month, and after not traveling for quite a long time, so I was very happy with that. Being able to travel, being able to see people in an almost normal circumstances.
Well, I'm just going to sit here and be incandescent with jealousy at the thought of anybody getting to go to Italy who wasn't me. It is, as you know, Enrico, one of my very favourite places. However, I don't think it really comes up in the rest of the show. And we are going first to California. Unless you've got from now till we get to the different items to think about ways you can shoehorn Italy angles in.
Okay.
I'm quietly confident. But we will start with California, where voters have determined that Governor Gavin Newsom can crack on with the job he was elected to do all of less than 3 years ago. By a convincing margin, Newsom defeated yesterday's recall election, substantially engineered by Republicans who were hoping to inconvenience Newsom at least and replace him with a talk radio carnival barker at most. The defeated candidate, Larry Elder, has already resorted to the frantic gibbering about imaginary electoral fraud, which now appears to be the default GOP play in such circumstances. Well, I'm joined now by Sasha Eisenberg, Monocle's contributor, indeed, in Los Angeles. Sasha, first of all, a hefty, indeed, thumping win by Governor Newsom. Do you get the sense that he was surprised by that?
It certainly was a surprise from where people saw this race 5 or 6 weeks ago, when it narrowed in some polls to show it even, and Democrats started taking this a lot more seriously than they had earlier in the year. I mean, I think in the last few weeks, it was clear that because we get reports on mail ballots for weeks before Election Day, we could see who was actually voting, and that Democrats and left-leaning independents were voting at a high rate. So Newsom's team felt pretty good going into yesterday. But the idea of winning this by 30 points at, you know, 2-1 margin, which is where we are at the moment, shocked everybody.
I mean, is there anything encouraging here as we look ahead to the midterms? Encouraging, and I don't even mean in a partisan way, but encouraging in the idea that what are fairly obvious spoiling, thwarting, and wrecking tactics by the Republican Party just aren't going to carry a majority?
Yeah, I mean, some of this is needs to be seen in the context of California's very peculiar state laws, and this is not an option that is available to voters in every state, and the threshold to qualifying a recall vote is shockingly low here. And so this is not a situation that's going to recreate itself in other places. What I think is has been, you know, affirming for both Democrats in a partisan sense, but more broadly, people who want to, you know, be aggressive in taking sort of responsible precautions against the virus, is that Newsom's opponents chose to basically call a snap election as a what they hoped would be a referendum on, they thought, his, you know, overly aggressive handling of lockdowns, school closures, mask requirements, vaccination mandates, and it backfired. And in the end, you know, it ended up serving as a confidence vote for the types of policies that, that he has imposed here, the types of policies that I think Joe Biden is warming to nationally. And there'll be two other gubernatorial elections, just, you know, normal scheduled elections this fall in Virginia and New Jersey. And the Democratic candidates there are not, you know, similarly not acting as though they are afraid of a sort of populist backlash to being too aggressive in their COVID measures.
And just finally, and this may be an even more riotously optimistic question, is there any chance that the Republican Party infers something from this about the merits of putting up an actual candidate rather than some Yahoo who enjoys being on television?
I don't believe so. I mean, if you know, there was the way this thing is structured is that you had 40 something candidates who were on a second ballot as an option if voters chose with a majority to remove Newsom. The guy who the so-called carnival barker, Larry Elder, a conservative, provocative sort of Los Angeles radio host, got over is getting over 40% of that second ballot vote. What it has done is emboldened him certainly to run in earnest next year, and I think that all signs point to the likely situation where he is the leading Republican in a, you know, some version of a rematch next November on the normal schedule when Newsom seeks a second term. But it's going to scare more conventional sort of moderate establishment Republicans from even trying to defeat Elder for a place in that general election.
Sasha Eisenberg, thank you for joining us. Let us now turn to this shore of the Atlantic. And as the European Union has become ever more significant politically and economically, it has never quite settled on an answer of how significant it should be militarily. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen clearly believes it is past time that the EU got to grips with this. Making her annual State of the Union address, von der Leyen went big on the idea that the EU needed greater capacity to confront threats and crises, not merely militarily but politically, and possibly without asking the US first. Enrico, a significant quote from her speech was she said, "You can have the most advanced forces in the world, but if you're never prepared to use them, of what use are they?" Is she entirely wrong? Has the EU been coasting for rather a while now on this front?
I think she's right, and I do have an Italian angle on this. Because the Italian Defense Minister Guerini was in London today meeting his counterpart, and he said something about von der Leyen's speech, saying that actually there is already a wide cooperation in different fields, in different fronts among European countries. There was in Afghanistan, there has been in Libya, in the Middle East. What is missing is the political will, as she said, to use a force and to put it together. And to have the political will, but French President Macron has spoken about this, it's a big jump for the European Union. And I don't know how and when they will be able to, you know, put the money, the resources that are needed for this, and the agreement to use force when it's needed.
Holly, it strikes me that there are a few things going on here. There's the obvious fright the EU got from the Donald Trump presidency and the idea that maybe we are going to have to look after ourselves. And while I don't think there's any meaningful danger of, for example, President Biden flouncing out of NATO, he seems clearly less interested in Europe than quite a few of his predecessors. But also from the EU's point of view, they no longer have to deal with the UK standing in the way of, you know, this was always the thing. Anytime somebody floated any idea of an EU defence force, for example, it was always the United Kingdom saying absolutely not.
Well, I think for starters, thinking about Trump here for a second, I mean, one of his qualms with the European Union was that they weren't paying enough to NATO. And I mean, if they have money to throw elsewhere, they might as well throw it at NATO, which is the force they have right now. I hate to sound like Trump, but I mean, I think there's that's the sensible first thing they should be doing. But I mean, the reality is, Afghanistan was one of the points she was making in our speech. And I mean, I think that was an example of why you shouldn't go and intervene in other countries. We had that with Libya, and that also didn't work well. So maybe we shouldn't be intervening in countries to begin with. Maybe we should focus on building up Europe, building up the United States, for example, instead of deciding that, oh, which country should we be invading next and will not really be needing our help and we'll be just making things worse. So, I mean, that's my two cents. I'm very much an isolationist right now.
But Enrico, what struck me about von der Leyen's speech was it sounded very much like a speech that you might wish somebody in her position had given roughly 30 years ago, when, of course, there was a huge crisis literally on the EU's borders, about which, and this is the break up of Yugoslavia, about which the EU seemed absolutely baffled and frankly accomplished absolutely nothing until the United States decided it, you know, that it had to take this seriously if nobody else was going to.
Well, if we look into the future with what happened in the past in former Yugoslavia, definitely Europe should have the means to do something. But as Oli said, difficult to imagine that they'll put the money now. There is NATO already there. The problem is that they should first perhaps integrate the European Union, make the European Union into a real super state with, you know, common, not just common monetary policy, but common fiscal policy. And perhaps I am a pro-European. I would love to see the European becoming the European state, the United European States, you know. Then you'll have a force. Each military of many of the European countries have special forces of high quality that have been used successfully, and they're not less successful than the Americans. But it takes a lot of money to be a military superpower. European Union is already an economic superpower, one of the strongest in the world. To be a military superpower, America puts a lot of money into the Pentagon. And I don't know if Europe, which is used to having America, you know, taking care of that, is ready to go for it.
Just a final quick thought on this one, Holly. How substantially would this end up recalibrating relationships within the EU? Because, as I think you mentioned, President Emmanuel Macron has been vociferously keen on the idea of an EU army, but that is surely because he understands that, or at least believes that, by default, France would end up in charge of it.
Well, I think they're looking at the fact that the United States is kind of turning towards east, towards Asia, and they're thinking, well, we have some other problems. We have Russia next door. We have a lot of things going on. We should be focusing on maybe just... I think they're under the impression that the U.S. will be distracted. But the reality is the U.S. is going to be there. There's a reason NATO exists. We saw after 9/11 Article 5 being evoked, and that was basically one of us gets hit, all of us get involved. And I think that will always be there. If anything was going to happen to Europe, the United States would be the first one there to help them out. So I think there's, and I looking at some of the pieces I was reading about this today, a lot of countries were kind of adverse to the idea of it because they think that would actually hurt ties with the United States. And I think that that could be also true as well.
Well, Article 5 was, of course, or that invocation of Article 5 was what led NATO into Afghanistan, which is what we are talking about next, via American history, where Thomas Jefferson famously wrote that, given a choice between a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, he should not hesitate to choose the latter. On this, as on much else, the Taliban disagree. By one new estimate, since the Taliban returned to power in Afghanistan last month, 153 media outlets across 20 provinces have closed, and nobody expects that they will be the last. The reasons for the shutdown are both brute finances, advertising has rather dried up, being now illegal, and plain brutality. There have been dozens of plausible stories of Afghan journalists being threatened, imprisoned, beaten, and worse. But in better than nothing news, Deutsche Welle has launched a new radio service for listeners in Afghanistan this week. And earlier we heard on Monocle 24 from Debarati Guha, the director of programs for Asia at Deutsche Welle, who told us more about the service and its purpose.
When this Taliban took over, we had to decide what we can do for the country. And that's the reason we started the daily radio programs in Dari and Pashto via shortwave from Monday, which was 13th of September, of course, to provide credible information to listeners in Afghanistan. And of course, this is the first step because, you know, we cannot give up. We cannot be defensive. We have to go offensive on this line. But I also know because the situation in Afghanistan has changed rapidly after this, and most broadcasters are not able to adopt with this new change, we still do not know what laws the Taliban will have for broadcasting in Afghanistan and what level of freedom the broadcasters will cherish. We also don't know that how long they will allow free access or to internet, though I know that even Taliban uses WhatsApp and Telegram for communication. These are the questions which came in front of us, and we thought that we have to do something. Also, we have a lot of local staff, and the department is here. We have really talented broadcast journalists, so we thought, why not? What we want to do is that we want to provide still free and better information to the people of Afghanistan, not only in cities like Kabul, but also which are far away places and regions like Kandahar and Herat and all these places, so that people have the freedom to access information which is not biased, which is as neutral as possible. These are war zones, and in war zone, people need information. People in war zone need to know what is happening around them. They need to know what their rights are. And more importantly, they need to know what the world is saying about their country.
Holly, it's a generous gesture by Deutsche Welle. As she explains, they'll be broadcasting in Pashto and Dari on shortwave. Depressing though it is that this is what Afghanistan's, you know, until very recently, extremely lively local media looked like. Is this going to matter? Will this make a difference?
I mean, I think the irony is that there are other news organizations that do that sort of thing already that have been doing it for years. BBC Persian and BBC Pashto already exists, and I believe that they do broadcast radio. So it's not that they're unique in this regard, but I mean, I think that the reality is, like the person that was just mentioning, we don't know what the new Afghanistan is going to be like in terms of rules and regulations. But looking back in the past, we know that they were hanging televisions in the street. So, I mean, how long is it before we start seeing that again? Because I know some people are looking at the Taliban and saying, oh, this is the new and improved Taliban. They're more moderate. I've seen some experts saying, and I look at them and I say, well, they're more diplomatically savvy. They're more maybe social media savvy. But this is the same Taliban. And right now, the only reason things look not as bad as we think is because the international community is still very much focused on the story of Afghanistan. I want to know in 6 months' time where things will be at. And right now, I'm not very optimistic.
Enrico, is there an idea here that could perhaps be taken a bit further? Because one of the things that we do know that has happened in the last month is that an extraordinary talent pool of Afghan journalists who have grown up in the last 20 years of relative freedom have found themselves having to leave the country or being chased out of the country. It shouldn't be beyond someone's wit, should it not, to establish some sort of, you know, radio-free Afghanistan, if you like, and actually find a way for these people to continue to report for their country and report about their country.
I think they should do it, and I think the West should fund these medias. I think it's interesting that now we have a German media trying to have this, this program in Pashtun. It is true that the BBC does it too. These used to be the sort of things that the Voice of America also did. Mm. You know, it was called, considered you used to be considered the voice of the CIA at some point, but it is interesting because it goes back to what we were saying about Ursula von der Leyen and the military force. One of the reasons, maybe because the European president made a speech, is that the withdrawal of America from Afghanistan made Europe wonder, you know, Article 5, well, what if Russia attacks the Baltic? Will America be ready to die for the Baltics? And in the same way, now I see that a German a news agency is starting to, you know, trying to do something for Afghanistan. Maybe it's part of the same feeling that Europe got to get its act together and do something where they believe it's needed. And with all these journalists, they definitely need some money, someone who let them do their job. Because in Afghanistan, surprise, surprise, the Taliban will not let freedom of the press prosper.
Just going back to what you were saying about exactly that, Holly, and about the difference between Taliban 2.0 and Taliban 1.0, and I can remember myself what the media landscape under Taliban 1.0 was like, which is to say that I can remember sitting on my balcony at the Intercontinental Hotel in Kabul with my shortwave radio desperately trying to tune in the BBC World Service over the mountains. Even if the Taliban, the resurgent Taliban, that is, are instinctively and ideologically that isolationist and obscurantist. Can they realistically do that, though, given the way that the media has changed in the 20 years since they were last there? By which I mean, certainly in late 90s Afghanistan, nobody owned a mobile phone, hardly anybody had a computer, never mind one attached to the internet. As you correctly say, hardly anybody had a television because the Taliban had seized and smashed them all and built checkpoints out of them.
Well, I think the one thing that's different is the Afghan people. I mean, they've had a taste of what things are like when it's not under the
ground. Which they had not in the 90s.
In the 90s, yeah. I mean, they've had a taste of democracy and in some ways some elements of freedom. I mean, there's still a lot of other issues there. But I think what the Taliban could potentially do, which is take the Iran route, which is actually crack down on the internet, put up a great wall of a great firewall of censorship. They could scramble satellite channels. It's not very hard. I mean, literally, their neighbor next door does that all the time. So, I mean, potentially that could be the direction the Taliban takes things. But again, I'm not very optimistic looking at the things on the ground right now. And I mean, to be frank, I don't even know if the Taliban will be able to sustain even the interim government it has right now. I think there's a lot of infighting I've been reading about. So, I mean, in 6 months' time, a lot of things could be different. So,
Holly Dagres and Enrico Franceschini, thank you both for the moment. You are listening to The Monocle Daily. We will have more right after this.
For more than 130 years, Allianz has expanded its business and stretched its brand in new and innovative ways. And while the world looks very different today than it did back in 1890, one truth remains. Allianz's passion for securing people's lives and giving them courage for what's ahead, no matter what. The world is a better place when people have more courage than fear, especially in uncertain times. People seek stability and confidence. By supporting each other and sharing resources across the world, Allianz has helped people to overcome their fears and look to the future with hope and with real confidence. Marika Dotschardis is a middle and long distance runner, a former acrobat and a sports psychologist who works with client athletes to help them unlock, build and maintain confidence. Marika, it's great to talk with you. What's the most rewarding thing about being an athlete?
So for me, the most rewarding thing about being an athlete is the same thing, but from two different perspectives. The one, I love seeing people conquer adversity, conquer challenges, go through hard times, and then succeed, and then work towards their success and ultimately experiencing what they've worked for such a long time. And being there for them and being along for that journey and being somehow able to help them in some capacity along that way and through those rough patches is just so gratifying. And at the same time, as an athlete myself, going through adversity and being supported by the people close to me, and then ultimately achieving that thing that I worked for so long, that I've endured so much for, and that I've sacrificed so much for, that's just so rewarding to me. One reason why I love working with high-performing athletes, and why I also am still an athlete myself, is that sport is this area where we experience such a broad range of intense human emotions, from intense joy to intense suffering and intense sorrow. And that is just really, really rewarding to me, because we rarely get to experience this range and this intensity of emotion and these colorful emotions in other areas of our lives. And I don't know why, but it's just what's fascinating to me in sports, because it's just so rare in normal life.
Marika Dotschardis on unlocking, building and maintaining confidence today and tomorrow. With Allianz, you can take confidence in tomorrow. Allianz, behind you for what's ahead.
Welcome back to the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. Still with me are our guests Holly Dagres and Enrico Franceschini. Let us now turn to developments in the saga of the Iran nuclear deal, the potential revival thereof. Iran's new president, Ebrahim Raisi, does not appear one of life's natural compromises, but has nevertheless sounded more or less amenable to the idea. The current becalming of the deal is not, of course, Iran's fault. It was US President Donald Trump who flounced in 2018, since when Iran has been trying, not unreasonably, to improve its own position within the framework. One minor concession was made this weekend. New memory cards will be inserted into cameras monitoring Iran's nuclear sites. However, a possible candidate to be Iran's new chief nuclear negotiator sounds like no fun at all. Holly, we do need probably to introduce the character of Ali Bagheri Khani. Is he going to be the new chief nuclear negotiator? And if he is, what signal is Iran sending there?
Well, the rumor is that he probably will be. And I think the signal is that they are very much in. This is someone that is a hardliner, just like the rest of the government.
And this is someone Iranians call a hardliner.
Yes,
right?
Yes. But also, and I think it's worth noting that all three branches of Iran's government are also hardline led, so they're all in sync. But this is somebody that was not very much for the Iran nuclear agreement from the get-go. And I think it's noteworthy that the guy that may have kind of pushed for him to take this role is someone by the name of Saeed Jalili, who was a Mahmoud Ahmadinejad era nuclear negotiator. And he put a burr under the saddle of nuclear negotiators back in the early 2000s, including who we now know as current CIA Director William Burns. Rather than actually talking about nuclear issues, he spent hours talking about the crimes of the United States during the Iran-Iraq War. So I think that should kind of give you the mindset of what this potential nuclear negotiator would look like.
Enrico, it has been my suspicion, and Holly will doubtless correct me if I'm wrong about this, that basically Iran has not been able to believe its luck since Donald Trump flounced in 2018, because they can drag this on forever and they can keep inventing new conditions and imposing new things and wanting new concessions, and they could run out the clock on this for years yet, couldn't they?
Well, they can, but we don't know what Biden's intentions are. And I don't know how lucky they were, really, with Trump, because they had an agreement in place. And the problem is that not only now the world is, let's say, threatened by the possibility of nuclear Iran, but pulling out of that agreement, Donald Trump helped the hardliners gain ground in Iran. And I'm very sorry to see in the new government there is not a guy like the former foreign minister Zafir, one of the best minds of Iran, a true, passionate negotiator with whom the West could work. Iran has a side that is not hardline, but thanks to Donald Trump, now they are, backing in the corner. and we'll have to wait for their chance to you know, gain ground.
Holly, there's always a silent partner, or indeed non-attending partner at these discussions, and that is, of course, Israel. And you will have seen these quotes from Benny Gantz, the Minister of Defence, this week, who I think basically is gently reminding everybody that ultimately Israel is the guarantor of last resort here, and that if it ever does think that Iran is getting anywhere near a nuclear weapon, then they will do what they did in Iraq in 1981 or Syria in 2007. Benny Gantz, the Minister of Defence, saying this week that Iran would accept a new deal, but he also said, and I quote, "If push comes to shove, we'll get there. We're not America, but we have our capabilities." That's not a subtle reminder, is it?
No, it's not. And it's a reminder we've been hearing probably for about two decades now. We heard it under the prime ministership of Benjamin Netanyahu, who would actually make it a whole thing at the United Nations General Assembly
every
year.
He drew a little cartoon, didn't he?
Yeah, an acme bomb. And I mean, I think we might miss him this year. I don't think Naftali Bennett's going to have any fun cartoons to show off, but who knows? This is something that hasn't been new. We've known this for a while. I thought it was interesting that Foreign Policy magazine had done an interview and had quoted Benny Gantz, the defense minister, as saying that, if we could roll back the program, we'd be accepting of the deal. Mm-hmm. And then a few hours later, after this interview came out, which would be today, they apparently walked back on that comment. So, I mean, I think that the Israel policy is that we have a right to defend ourselves and we will do whatever we need to.
Enrico, do you get a clear sense of what it is Iran does actually want before that they will re-sign this? Well, they don't have to re-sign the deal, they're in it. I guess it's more about under what circumstances would they be willing to grudgingly allow America to re-sign it?
Well, I admit I don't have an idea of what they want. What probably, you know, money first of all, and the end of sanctions and the possibilities of strengthening their position as much as possible in terms in economic terms, in political terms. I don't know how much what the West can do to, you know, play this hand in a better way against an hardline government like what Iran has today. Because the West, now America, Biden, needs an agreement to come back. He needs to cancel all the mess he has left Afghanistan. So he needs a success. And Iran can offer him a success, but so he has to concede something to get it.
Enrico and Holly, we will have more from you in our And Finally story shortly. And believe me, listeners, you are going to want to stick around for that one. But first, Turkey's next presidential election is scheduled for 2023, but it does seem that the race is already on. As the country cracks down on refugees trying to flee Afghanistan, politicking over refugees is already a major issue. Our contributor in Istanbul, Ruth Michelson, sent us this dispatch.
Turkey is home to the largest refugee population in the world. 4 million refugees currently reside in Turkey. The presence of refugees is a source of pride for some, but those numbers have declined. Earlier this year, one opposition mayor in the country's northwest announced he planned to charge foreign residents 10 times more for water and waste. In August, Turkish police arrested almost 80 people in the capital Ankara for a series of attacks on businesses. Less than a month later, thousands of Turkish football fans chanted, "We don't want any refugees in our country," during a World Cup qualifying match. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has constantly tried to position Turkey as a global power, a protector of Muslims around the world, and that includes refugees. In 2019, he said, "Our culture of hospitality compelled us to shoulder the burden of hosting millions of war victims with very little help from the international community." He referred to our Syrian brothers and sisters and said, "We could not shut our doors in their faces."
Dünyasında mülteci sorununa coğrafi uzaklık, yakınlık merceğinden bakma lüksü yoktur.
Erdogan has also tried to use Turkey's acceptance of refugees as a bargaining chip with the European Union, notably as part of a 2016 deal to stem the numbers of migrants entering Europe in exchange for aid and resettlement agreements. But now he's facing pushback at home from both allies and opponents, all taking aim at Turkey's refugee policies. But now he's facing pushback at home from both opponents and allies, all taking aim at Turkey's refugee policies. Even parties in coalition with his ruling Justice and Development Party, or AKP, are lining up to attack both Erdogan and the AKP ahead of an election due to be held in 2023, but could be held as soon as next year. 5 years after Turkey's landmark migration deal with the EU, and 10 years after it began accepting refugees from Syria, refugee politics are already central to the election. In a bid to separate themselves from the AKP's talk of accepting refugees, most of Turkey's political parties are now lining up to attack Erdogan from the right. In the words of Turkey's Daily Sabah newspaper, the refugee issue has taken a center seat in Turkish politics. No party has seized on this quite as consistently in recent months as the Republican People's Party, or CHP. The party says its focus is social democracy, as the party of Turkey's founding father, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk.
Bir kez daha iktidar vurgusu yaptı. Gençlere vaatlerini müjde mesajıyla sosyal medyadan duyurdu.
İsteyen bu videoyu indirebilir ya da atın baba.
CHP chair Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu said in July, "We will say our goodbyes to our Syrian guests and we will send them to their homes in 2 years during our rule. This is one of the 5 priorities of our rule." A poll released in June showed Erdogan losing in a head-to-head runoff with the leaders of all other major parties, including the CHP. Sensing an opportunity, Kılıçdaroğlu is urging Erdogan to have an early election, when he thinks the CHP could win. In May, he told Erdogan, "Don't run away from an election." The CHP hung banners with the words, "The border is our honor."
Haydi Erdogan! Vakit tamam, seçim zamanıdır şimdi bu zaman. Allah'ını seversen seçimden kaçma. Artık kaçma kardeşim. Haydi Erdoğan.
But the opposition's anti-refugee stance has given Erdogan an opportunity, particularly as the government moves to ban the pro-Kurdish, pro-immigration HDP party. Erdogan's government hasn't always been so kind to refugees. Erdogan said himself that those who fail to integrate by learning Turkish should return home when the war in Syria ends, and his government has also tried to move Syrians in Turkey out of urban centres. But Kılıçdaroğlu's statements give Erdogan and the AKP an opportunity to look good. After the CHP declared they would send Syrian refugees back home, Erdogan responded, "We will not throw the people of God that have been seeking refuge here to the hands of killers."
Şan iş dünyasının çok saygın insanları var. Eskiden fabrikaları vardı. Şimdi diyeceğiz ki git kardeşim oralara fabrikalarını kur.
In polls, Turkish citizens increasingly express anti-migrant sentiment, easily stoked by these debates. A recent study from Istanbul's Turkish German University's Migration and Integration Research Center said 72% of Turks believe that Syrian refugees will harm Turkey's socio-cultural structure. 74% think that public services will either deteriorate or diminish because of refugees. Politicians have been eager to stoke anti-refugee sentiment, now rising further as increasing numbers flee the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan. Erdogan's government has taken a different position on Afghan refugees to arrivals from Syria. This might be because of pre-election pressure, even from within his ruling coalition with the nationalist MHP party.
Türkiye olarak İran üzerinden gerçekleşen ve giderek yoğunlaşan bir Afgan göçmen dalgasıyla karşı karşıyayız.
Erdogan said Turkey is facing a new wave of refugees from Afghanistan in a speech in mid-August. He talked about stabilizing Afghanistan instead of helping refugees. He's also told European politicians that Turkey will not accept more refugees. Turkey has no duty, responsibility, or obligation to be Europe's refugee warehouse, he said. Turkey is now extending a wall along its eastern border in an effort to stop migrants entering. Originally built in 2017, the government is now extending 64 kilometers of concrete along the border and guarding the remaining area with ditches, wire, and security patrols. Turkish police have also stepped up efforts to detain refugees that they find, which states that those fleeing persecution have a right to claim asylum. The border wall is no win for human rights, especially as history shows that desperate people fleeing conflict will find a way through. Yet Erdogan is hoping his anti-refugee politics will play well with European figures looking to Turkey to stem the flow of migration. And as attacks from the CHP, MHP and other parties continue, Erdogan is also hoping that cracking down on refugees might help him and the AKP in the coming elections. For Monocle in Istanbul, I'm Ruth Michelson.
Thank you, Ruth. And finally, although aficionados of and finally stories might feel like they've heard this one once or twice before, but whatever, a group of boffins claim that they're about 6 years away from resurrecting the woolly mammoth. A firm called Colossal intends to tempt the fates and millions of deeply unamusing quips about Jurassic Park by working from DNA recovered from mammoth tusks, bones, teeth and hair. It says here, Holly, how excited are you about the comeback of the woolly mammoth?
So excited.
you don't want one?
No. I want a T-Rex.
I mean, give them a break. They've got to start with something. I mean, woolly, I mean, you don't pile straight in on the T-Rex. You start off with something. I'm guessing this is easier. I don't really know.
I guess they must have really liked the movie Ice Age. I mean, why are they leaning on that?
I think possibly because it's doable is the sense I get from my frankly desultory research into the question. But what we did actually want to put to our panel, and I will start with Enrico, is there any extinct animal which, if given the power, you would bring back?
I must answer no, really. I'm against this project. I don't understand. If it is true, I'm surprised. The most surprising thing is that this is not just a project, Andrew, but I read that they raised $15 million. So I would like to know who gave them $15 million.
Somebody who really wants a woolly mammoth.
Yeah, maybe unless you want to put it in a circus, you know, bring back animals to the circus and take it on a tour around the world and think this will make a lot of money, or maybe use it in a movie, in an Hollywood movie, because the idea that this can help, you know, fight climate change does not convince me. So I would save the animals we have.
There's right nothing now you want to bring back at all? To hell with them all and good riddance. That's your attitude.
Exactly.
Oh, fair enough. See, my insufferable hipster yet Australian home crowd choice would be the thylacine, the so-called Tasmanian tiger, the last one of which I think died in 1935 in Beaumaris Zoo in Hobart. It wasn't actually a tiger. It was called that because it had stripes on it.
It was sort of
a wolfy kind of thing.
Beautiful.
No, that would have been.
That's more sensible, though. Yes. I mean, it's like the 20th century. Like, let's focus on the things we just killed. Why are we thinking about something that was, like, from the Ice Age? And, I mean, like Enrico was saying, climate change. I mean, geez, like, we can't even keep the polar bears alive. Exactly. You want to keep the woolly mammoth alive right now.
Well, the good news is if the Australian news cycle adheres to its usual rhythms, we're never more than about another fortnight away from some or other outlet running with grainy out-of-focus footage of a fox going through someone's bins and the headline, "Is this the thylacine?" You will all be familiar with the usual rule about headlines which end in a question mark. That is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. A big thanks to my panellists today, Enrico Franceschini and Holly Dagres. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and researched by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Our sound engineer was Steph Chungu. I'm Andrew Miller here in London. The Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.